give growth to native trees with shrublands to reduce the fires?
I wouldn't say that was done intentionally, but certainly we see the effect of high severity fires today leading to an increase in the amount of shrubland in areas that were formerly conifer dominated forests.
What would you like to see policymakers use insights from your study to perhaps develop more effective wildfire mitigation policies?
Well, I think it's important just to realize the changes that have occurred on the landscape from historical conditions to now and the drivers of those changes. And so if we can do anything to reduce the probability of high severity fires, we can't eliminate fire, but we can choose how our fires burn in the future. And so if we can practice those fuel reduction treatments and things like that, that help forests manage fires better and help fire managers manage fires better, I think that would be a benefit.
Earlier, we were talking about tree rings. How far back do those go? Are we talking about centuries of history?
Yeah, the tree ring chronologies that we've developed the fire scar record from tend to go back at least a couple hundred years. In some areas, like in the southwestern United States, we can get back 500 years. And there's a very special set of collections from the giant sequoia groves in Southern California that actually go back thousands of years.
Are there really major differences between the wildfires of, like, say, the year 1600 to 2000?
Yeah, I think in general what we see are these historical fires were very extensive. They could burn entire landscapes, but they might burn very slowly, and they typically burn on the surface. They did not leave any evidence of large, high-severity patches that, you know, were killing trees and, say, converting those forests to shrublands the way we see now pretty regularly occurring after our larger high-severity fires.
As a scientist, were you surprised at the severity of the fires in California earlier this year?
Unfortunately, no, I was not. I can't speak to the fires in January directly, but those types of fires that are burning from wildlands into communities are unfortunately pretty common now. We're seeing them year after year. And in areas where the combination of urban planning and drought and fuel combine, we could expect to see more fires like that.
Chris, what are the next steps for your research? Are there other aspects of wildfire history or management that you plan to explore?
Yeah, absolutely. We're really trying to dig into this question of extent of fires going forward, looking at the extent of fires across the Western U.S. and individual fires in particular. You know, one question is, are the really large sort of quote unquote mega fires of today, that the really historic record breaking fires, are they larger than what you would expect from the last several hundred years, say?
I remember when I was a kid, I used to see the promos for Smokey the Bear and Only You Can Prevent Forest Fires. Is that still being done to, you know, educate the next generation, or is that sort of passé at this point?
No, the fire prevention strategies and prevention education is still very important. We don't want to have accidental ignitions that create large problems. I don't want to see houses or property burned up in fires any more than anybody else does. But we do need to add some nuance that not all fires are bad and destructive and catastrophic, that fire can be a very useful tool in a forest ecosystem and actually very beneficial for the forest. And so I think there is a pathway where we can coexist with fire and have a healthy relationship with forests that includes fire and fuels management.
Chris Gitterman, research scientist at the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to InfoTrack, a production of Syndication Networks.
At Skechers, we put the S in comfort.
Wait. Skechers put the S in comfort?
Yes. Comfort you have to feel to believe. Skechers, we put the S in comfort.
Let me try. Okay, I'm just stepping in and... Oh, wow. Skechers put the S in comfort.
Duh, we told you.
Find Skechers slip-ins at a Skechers store, Skechers.com, or wherever stylish footwear is sold.
Hey, Green Goblin here. So you've got a clogged drain in your bathroom. Water in the sink's overstaying its welcome. You're spitting today's toothpaste on top of yesterday's toothpaste. You hope that it'd go away. Yeah, clogs don't just go away. I make them go away. I'm Green Goblin, the only clog dissolver you need. I'm bleach-free, safe for your pipes, and I work. Guaranteed or your money back. Because I never met a clog that was going to unclog itself. Green Gobbler. Let the gobbler get it.
High school athletes burn a lot of energy. The right sports nutrition can make all the difference. But most young athletes are getting the wrong nutrition. InfoTrack reporter Gina Tedesco has the details. Gina?
Thanks, Chris. Joining us now is Jen Fields, assistant professor of nutritional science in the University of Connecticut's College of Agriculture, Health, and Natural Resources. She was a key researcher on a study of high school athletes' knowledge of nutrition. Professor, although the study focused on athletes, would you say that a lack of proper nutrition instruction is affecting most or all high schoolers, athletes or not?
I would absolutely have to agree with that. I think back to when I was in high school. In health class, we never learned about nutrition. It wasn't a topic really of interest. We didn't have access to nutrition professors. And nowadays with social media, a lot of athletes and just general students are turning towards social media for nutrition knowledge and not getting a proper education in it. So I definitely absolutely agree with your comment.
And among the students you studied, how would you then characterize their level of general nutrition knowledge and sports nutrition knowledge?
First off, we found no sex differences between boys and girls in their level of nutrition knowledge. But when it comes to general nutrition knowledge, athletes scored about 55% of questions correctly regarding that. And then in specifically as it pertains to sport nutrition knowledge, athletes scored about a 35% on that category. So pretty low, as you can see.
And in your study, what sorts of wrong ideas did the students hold about, like, for example, how much carbohydrates, protein, and fat are best for them?
Yeah, so they significantly underestimated how many calories they need and carbohydrates that they need. What's funny is they way overestimated how much protein they need. And I'll be the first to admit I am a huge supporter for a high protein diet. But these kids thought that they needed three times the amount of protein that they actually needed. And same thing with dietary fat as well. They thought they needed three times the amount. So under eating calories and carbs, but then also thinking that they needed a lot more of protein and fat.
And if we switch that around, in fact, how much of a student athlete's daily calories should come from carbohydrates?
About 55%. So a majority of their calories should come from carbohydrates. About 55% from carbs, about 30% from protein, 25 to 30% from protein, and then about 20, 25% coming from fat.
And what about intermittent fasting? Bad idea for an athlete?
Horrible idea for an athlete. We need our athletes to be consistently eating throughout the day. So it's really recommended that they are consuming three meals interspersed by quite a few snacks with a big emphasis on eating right before practice or training or sport and right after as well.
And what about hydration then? Is that a piece of the puzzle here that they're getting wrong?
Absolutely. Focusing on adequate hydration all throughout the day and also keeping in mind that hydration is not only water and that they can actually get water through eating plenty of fruits and vegetables. But of course, always having a handy water bottle is a great idea. And then during their sport, probably referring to something like Gatorade or sports drink. So they're getting a little bit more electrolytes and carbohydrates to support their sport demands.
We're visiting with Jen Fields, Assistant Professor of Nutritional Science in the University of Connecticut's College of Agriculture, Health, and Natural Resources. She participated in a study, now published in the journal Nutrients, of high schoolers' nutrition knowledge. Professor, in addition to athletes having enough energy to power their performances, what other important effects do athletes get from having proper nutrition?
It's going to help them recover. It's going to help them focus in school. It's going to help them really support their health long term. And what a lot of athletes don't realize, or really kids in general, what they don't realize is their health right now is really setting the stage for their long term health many years from now. And for example, peak bone mass is accrued by the time kids are about 20 years old or so. So this high school and early college is such a key population where we need to make sure they're getting adequate calories, protein, vitamin D, and calcium to support their growing skeleton. skeleton, because if they're not getting those nutrients now, then it sets them up for increased risk of injury, but also increased risk of osteoporosis later on in life.
Jen Fields, Assistant Professor of Nutritional Science in the University of Connecticut's College of Agriculture, Health, and Natural Resources. Thank you so much for joining us today. Very interesting topic.
Thank you so much, Gina.
For InfoTrack, I'm Gina Tedesco.
That's it for another edition of InfoTrack. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm Chris Whitting, inviting you to join us next week for another edition of InfoTrack.
101.1 FM WHSM Hayward, Muskie 101.
This is InfoTrack, the weekly show with information you should know. Here's what's happening on this week's show.
A majority of 65-year-old Americans will one day need long-term health care. But will they be able to afford it? Don't wait until it's too late. Learn how to better prepare for your healthcare costs in retirement.
On the medical front, people are pretty well insured. Almost everyone has Medicare. Those costs can be higher than expected, but it's not likely to break the bank. On the long-term care front, people have a lot of misconceptions.
Then, a scientist says ancient fire management practices can save our modern forests from devastating destruction.
We do need to add some nuance that not all fires are bad and destructive and catastrophic, that fire can be a very useful tool in a forest ecosystem and actually very beneficial for the forest.
Stay with us. InfoTrack begins right after this.
At Skechers, we put the S in comfort. Now, I know you're probably spelling comfort in your head and asking yourself, is that possible? Am I just a really bad speller? Look, I don't know your spelling aptitude, but Skechers most definitely put the S in comfort, because Skechers is the comfort technology company and has developed fits and features that change everything you know about comfort, like hands-free Skechers slip-ins, the ultimate in comfort and convenience. It's footwear you just step into and they're on, with no bending down. Find Skechers at a Skechers store, Skechers.com, or wherever stylish footwear is sold.
Hey, Green Goblet here. So you've got a clogged drain in your bathroom. Water in the sinks overstaying its welcome? You're spitting today's toothpaste on top of yesterday's toothpaste. You hope that it'd go away. Yeah, clogs don't just go away. I make them go away. I'm Green Goblet, the only clog dissolver you need. I'm bleach-free, safe for your pipes, and I work. Guaranteed or your money back. Because I never met a clog that was going to unclog itself. Green Goblet. Let the gobbler get it.
My friends swim no matter the season, but my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis can sometimes take me out of the moment. Now, thanks to Skyrizi and clear skin, count me in. With Skyrizi, Risankizumab Riza, a prescription-only 150 milligram injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. 3 out of 4 people achieve 90% clear skin at 4 months.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions and an increased risk of infections or a lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check for infection and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms, such as fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you plan to or recently received a vaccine.
Thanks to Skyrizi, there's nothing on my skin, and that means everything. Ask your doctor today about Skyrizi, the number one dermatologist-prescribed biologic in psoriasis. And visit Skyrizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
InfoTrack, the weekly show with information you should know. Here's your host, Chris Whitting.
Over 80% of 65-year-olds will one day need long-term health care, but are they financially prepared for it? Most severely underestimate these costs. Here with the story, InfoTrack's Roy Mackey. Roy?
Thanks, Chris. Gal Wetstein is a senior research economist at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, and he's here to discuss their recent report that examined how well older adults understand healthcare risks and whether advisors are actually helpful. Gal, set the stage a bit on this. What are the biggest misconceptions that older adults have about healthcare costs in retirement?
I think the biggest misconceptions are regarding the overall size. People don't have a good sense of how much they're going to have to spend on healthcare in retirement. and whether they're going to need it. A general theme of what we've found is that healthcare, which we divide into medical spending, which is things like doctors, drugs, hospital visits, and long-term care, which is more nursing, helping with getting out of bed, helping with walking around, things like that. On the medical front, people are pretty well insured. And so even if they don't quite understand how much they're going to spend, almost everyone has Medicare. Almost everyone who has Medicare has some form of supplemental coverage above and beyond traditional Medicare. And so those costs can be higher than expected, but it's not likely to break the bank. On the long-term care front, people have a lot of misconceptions, and those costs are not very well insured. And that can lead to a lot of unpleasant surprises.
What percentage of older adults end up needing long-term care, and is there an average age that that occurs?
We found in our research that for a 65-year-old today, the vast majority will need some amount of long-term care. Here we're talking about something like over 80% will need some amount of long-term care. Now, a lot of that is going to be low-intensity assistance with what we call instrumental activities of daily living. These are things like cooking, managing your budget, shopping, things like that. So some people will just need that, and they'll just need that for a short period of time. But then a good chunk of people will unfortunately need high-intensity care for extended periods of time. We're talking about almost 1 in 5 will need what we call high-intensity care, which is assistance with at least 2 of the list of activities of daily living, which is walking, getting out of bed, using the bathroom, showering, getting dressed, things like that, basic activities. So more than 2 of those, and we'll need that help for more than 3 years.
What are the main reasons that people don't purchase long-term care insurance?
Part of it is the misconceptions. Most people don't understand that they will very likely need this kind of care. Of the ones who do appreciate the care that they're going to need, there's a lot of people who think that health insurance will cover it, so that their Medicare will cover it, or that their Medicare Advantage or Medigap or the retiree plan from a past employer, people think that those kinds of insurance cover these kinds of non-medical care. This is kind of more personal care. But that's simply not true, not generally. So Medicare will cover, for example, some period of time in what's called a skilled nursing facility. If you've, say, had an operation and you need, say, a month of rehabilitation that also involves medical care, Medicare will cover some of that. But if you need something that isn't directly tied to an acute medical event, if you need it for a long period of time, Medicare and other health insurance doesn't cover it, and so people don't understand that. The other thing is that people just don't think about it, I think. It's very easy to put off decisions about buying insurance. You asked about the average age. Typically, people need this kind of care when they reach their 80s. Mid-80s is a typical time, and that seems like a long way off for people at the ages when they might buy this kind of insurance, which is usually 50s and 60s. After age 75, most insurers won't sell you long-term care, even if you want it.
Our guest on InfoTrack is Gaul Wettstein, senior research economist at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, and we're discussing a recent report from his organization that examined how well older adults understand healthcare risks and whether financial advisors are actually helpful. Gaul, the report suggests that financial advisors are aware of healthcare risks and costs, yet their clients remain largely uninformed. Why is that disconnect happening?
That's a really good question. I don't think we have a really clear answer. One hypothesis we have is that the people who have financial advisors are relying on them to keep track of all of this information, so they don't feel that they need it or that they need to do it themselves because they're paying someone to do it for them. That's one hypothesis. Yeah, I mean, we really do generally find that not only do the people with advisors have no better perception of these things, we often find that they have a worse perception.
So it's safe to say the retirees with financial advisors don't really make any better preparations?
That's not clear, because it could actually be that the advisors are doing what they presumably should be doing, which is offering advice. So you might not know all the details, but your advisor will tell you you should buy long-term care insurance, or they'll tell you you should talk to your kids about it, make other arrangements. I haven't mentioned it, but most long-term care is actually not paid care. It's informal care, most often from a spouse or an adult child. Insurance generally doesn't cover that. You generally don't have to pay for that, but that doesn't mean it's something that there's no cost to. It's just not a financial cost or not an immediate financial cost. But you might want to discuss these things with your kids, with your spouse, have plans in place for if and when needs arise.
Are there any other common mistakes that retirees make when planning for medical and long-term care expenses?
Past studies that we've done and others have done show that part of the reason why people misperceive their costs in retirement is that they underestimate how long retirement might be. So people tend to underestimate how long they're likely to live. And that ties into not really expecting the right amount of long-term care. It also, in general, leads people to underestimate how much they'll need to spend on medical care and on anything, on housing, on food, on everything. So one thing people might want to do when planning for retirement is just look at the life expectancy tables and see, they might be usually pleasantly surprised by how long they're likely to live. We found that people in their 60s and early 70s, when they're making these decisions, they tend to underestimate how long they're going to live.
Just to wrap things up, if there were one key takeaway from this study that consumers should act on right now, immediately, what would it be?
Begin thinking about how you would pay for these long-term care needs. I didn't mention, these are extremely expensive services. 1 year in a nursing home can easily cost $100,000 or more. And so these are things that people should plan for. The plan will depend on your situation. Some people should expect to rely on Medicaid, which is the biggest financer of formal care in the country. But some people don't know that that requires them to essentially give up all of their assets. So whatever your situation, if you want to leave money to your kids, if you have a spouse that lives in the community, you might want to consider other options, and you should look into it as soon as possible.
Interesting topic. Gal Wetstein, Senior Research Economist at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Thank you very much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And for InfoTrack, I'm Roy Mackey.
Next, wildfire management to tame the flames. That story as InfoTrack continues.
Stick around. There's more InfoTrack straight ahead.
Progressive knows there are some surprisingly expensive things in life, like frames. Because you found a classic 70s concert poster. But when you went to get it framed, you realized the frame will cost about four times the amount of the poster. Which is actually absurd, because no one will be looking at the frame, and if they are, then you severely overestimated how cool this poster is. But then you remember, by switching your home and auto to Progressive, you could save hundreds and put it towards a classic 70s concert poster in an absurdly overpriced frame. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates and other insurers. Not available in all states.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
My friends swim no matter the season, but my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis can sometimes take me out of the moment. Now, thanks to Skyrizi and clear skin, count me in. With Skyrizi, Risankizumab Riza, a prescription-only 150 milligram injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. 3 out of 4 people achieve 90% clear skin at 4 months.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions and an increased risk of infections or a lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check for infection and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms, such as fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you plan to or recently received a vaccine.
Thanks to Skyrizi, there's nothing on my skin, and that means everything. Ask your doctor today about Skyrizi, the number one dermatologist-prescribed biologic in psoriasis. And visit SkyRizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
InfoTrack continues. Once again, here's Chris Whitting.
We're heading into the heart of North America's forests to uncover surprising research about wildfires and what history can teach us about them. Joining us is Chris Gitterman, a research scientist at the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder. Chris, the idea that fewer wildfires today could lead to more severe fires later seems counterintuitive. Can you explain how that works?
Basically, in the past, we had a lot of low severity fires burning across the surface of forests, reducing fuel loads. Around the turn of the 20th century, due to a number of factors, those fires went away, and now we actively put them out, in many cases, not all the time. And without those fires burning, we have no way to reduce the fuels in sort of a natural cycle or kind of a historical fire cycle, and so we get a buildup of fuels.
Your study analyzed nearly 2,000 tree ring records. How do the records help scientists understand the history of wildfire patterns?
Well, the tree rings record the fires that burn throughout their lifetime. They, again, are low-severity fires, so they scar the trees but don't kill them. And the scars of those fires preserve within the trees. And so we can take a section of a stump or a log or a live tree, cross-date the tree rings, and get an exact date for the timing of that fire at that tree. And since we know where the tree grew, we can estimate the size, the extent of fires, and the frequency of fires in those places.
I see. Now, despite recent record-breaking fire years, modern fires are less frequent than in the past. Why is this? What factors contributed to this decline?
Mainly our suppression of fires, but even before that, we had land use changes, a massive reduction in indigenous populations throughout the continent. We had a lot of grazing of livestock that are non-native to the continent that reduced the fuels that fires had been burning on. So, you know, sheep and cattle eat grass. That's what the fires had been consuming. And then we had a lot of other land use changes, logging, and then active fire suppression starting after 1910, putting out fires that would otherwise reduce the spread and frequency of fires.
Now, you mentioned indigenous burning. What kind of practices did they do? They didn't obviously have modern equipment. How did they manage to keep those from destroying everything?
Well, indigenous peoples used fire for myriad purposes. They also reduced fuels in a number of different ways, you know, collection of firewood, breaking up the continuity of fuels through gardening kind of practices within forests. There's too many to list in the time we have, but they really could wisely manage fires by being in tune with the natural conditions in the forest. In some areas, a lot of lightning ignitions occurred that would help them out in terms of managing fires and kind of doing that work for them.
Your study mentions that historical fires coincided with drought episodes, but were still less severe. Why would you say droughts didn't lead to more destructive fires back then?
Well, I won't say that there were no destructive fires back then, but they happened probably at a lower extent than now because of that lack of fuel in the historical forest that we see. We've had fires burning in recent years under very extreme conditions, but in areas where there have been multiple fires over the last few decades, and they tend to not burn as severely because the fuel loads are lower.
In your view, what role should prescribed burning and mechanical fuel treatments play in modern wildfire management?
Well, those practices are important for reducing fuels, again, to reduce the risk of severe fire right now. We can eliminate ignitions on the landscapes, like all ignitions. We're going to get lightning, we're going to get human ignitions, but we can reduce fuels and make the probability of severe fire lower for the fires that burn today.
Our guest is Chris Gitterman, a research scientist at the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder. And Chris is a member of NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information Paleoclimate team. Climate change is apparently a factor increasing wildfire risks. How do your findings in this study point to future fire management strategies?
Well, we didn't study climate change specifically in this study. We just looked at the extent and frequency of historical fires compared to the extent and frequency of modern fires since the 1980s. But there's a lot of really good research out there that is able to attribute anthropogenic climate change to a large increase in area burned today and also in the severity of fires today, mainly through increasing the aridity of forest ecosystems and drying out fuels. So when you have drier fuels, you tend to get hotter fire, just like you would in your own fireplace. And the same is true for forests.
With some of these forests, have they replaced the native growths, the native trees, with shrublands to reduce the fires?
I wouldn't say that was done intentionally, but certainly we see the effect of high severity fires today leading to an increase in the amount of shrubland in areas that were formerly conifer-dominated forests.
What would you like to see policymakers use insights from your study to perhaps develop more effective wildfire mitigation policies?
Well, I think it's important just to realize the changes that have occurred on the landscape from historical conditions to now and the drivers of those changes. And so if we can do anything to reduce the probability of high severity fires, we can't eliminate fire, but we can choose how our fires burn in the future. And so if we can practice those fuel reduction treatments and things like that, that help forests manage fires better and help fire managers manage fires better, I think that would be a benefit.
Earlier, we were talking about tree rings. How far back do those go? Are we talking about centuries of history?
Yeah, the tree ring chronologies that we've developed the fire scar record from tend to go back at least a couple hundred years. In some areas, like in the southwestern United States, we can get back 500 years. And there's a very special set of collections from the giant sequoia groves in Southern California that actually go back thousands of years.
Are there really major differences between the wildfires of, like, say, the year 1600 to 2000?
Yeah, I think in general what we see are these historical fires were very extensive. They could burn entire landscapes, but they might burn very slowly, and they typically burn on the surface. They did not leave any evidence of large, high-severity patches that, you know, were killing trees and, say, converting those forests to shrublands the way we see now pretty regularly occurring after our larger high-severity fires.
As a scientist, were you surprised at the severity of the fires in California earlier this year?
Unfortunately, no, I was not. I can't speak to the fires in January directly, but those types of fires that are burning from wildlands into communities are unfortunately pretty common now. We're seeing them year after year. And in areas where the combination of urban planning and drought and fuel combine, we could expect to see more fires like that.
Chris, what are the next steps for your research? Are there other aspects of wildfire history or management that you plan to explore?
Yeah, absolutely. We're really trying to dig into this question of extent of fires going forward, looking at the extent of fires across the Western U.S. and individual fires in particular. You know, one question is, are the really large sort of quote unquote mega fires of today, that the really historic record-breaking fires, are they larger than what you would expect from the last several hundred years, say?
I remember when I was a kid, I used to see the promos for Smokey the Bear and Only You Can Prevent Forest Fires. Is that still being done to, you know, educate the next generation, or is that sort of passé at this point?
No, the fire prevention strategies and prevention education is still very important. We don't want to have accidental ignitions that create large problems. I don't want to see houses or property burned up in fires any more than anybody else does. But we do need to add some nuance that not all fires are bad and destructive and catastrophic, that fire can be a very useful tool in a forest ecosystem and actually very beneficial for the forest. And so I think there is a pathway where we can coexist with fire and have a healthy relationship with forest that includes fire and fuels management.
Chris Gitterman, research scientist at the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to InfoTrack, a production of Syndication Networks.
At Skechers, we put the S in comfort.
Wait. Skechers put the S in comfort?
Yes. Comfort you have to feel to believe. Skechers, we put the S in comfort.
Let me try. Okay, I'm just stepping in and... Oh, wow. Skechers put the S in comfort.
Duh. We told you.
Find Skechers slip-ins at a Skechers store, Skechers.com, or wherever stylish footwear is sold.
Hey, Green Goblet here. So you've got a clogged drain in your bathroom. Water in the sinks overstaying its welcome? You're spitting today's toothpaste on top of yesterday's toothpaste. You hope that it go away. Yeah, clogs don't just go away. I make them go away. I'm Green Gobbler, the only clog dissolver you need. I'm bleach-free, safe for your pipes, and I work. Guaranteed or your money back. Because I never met a clog that was going to unclog itself. Green Gobbler. Let the gobbler get it.
High school athletes burn a lot of energy. The right sports nutrition can make all the difference. But most young athletes are getting the wrong nutrition. InfoTrack reporter Gina Tedesco has the details. Gina?
Thanks, Chris. Joining us now is Jen Fields, assistant professor of nutritional science in the University of Connecticut's College of Agriculture, Health, and Natural Resources. She was a key researcher on a study of high school athletes' knowledge of nutrition. Professor, although the study focused on athletes, would you say that a lack of proper nutrition instruction is affecting most or all high schoolers, athletes or not?
I would absolutely have to agree with that. I think back to when I was in high school. In health class, we never learned about nutrition. It wasn't a topic really of interest. We didn't have access to nutrition professors. And nowadays with social media, a lot of athletes and just general students are turning towards social media for nutrition knowledge and not getting a proper education in it. So I definitely absolutely agree with your comment.
And among the students you studied, how would you then characterize their level of general nutrition knowledge and sports nutrition knowledge?
First off, we found no sex differences between boys and girls in their level of nutrition knowledge. But when it comes to general nutrition knowledge, athletes scored about 55% of questions correctly regarding that. And then in specifically as it pertains to sport nutrition knowledge, athletes scored about a 35% on that category. So pretty low, as you can see.
And in your study, what sorts of wrong ideas did the students hold about, like, for example, how much carbohydrates, protein, and fat are best for them?
Yeah, so they significantly underestimated how many calories they need and carbohydrates that they need. What's funny is they way overestimated how much protein they need. And I'll be the first to admit I am a huge supporter for a high protein diet. But these kids thought that they needed three times the amount of protein that they actually needed. And same thing with dietary fat as well. They thought they needed three times the amount. So under eating calories and carbs, but then also thinking that they needed a lot more of protein and fat.
And if we switch that around, in fact, how much of a student athlete's daily calories should come from carbohydrates?
About 55%. So a majority of their calories should come from carbohydrates. About 55% from carbs, about 30% from protein, 25 to 30% from protein, and then about 20, 25% coming from fat.
And what about intermittent fasting? Bad idea for an athlete?
Horrible idea for an athlete. We need our athletes to be consistently eating throughout the day. So it's really recommended that they are consuming three meals intersped by quite a few snacks with a big emphasis on eating right before practice or training or sport and right after as well.
And what about hydration then? Is that a piece of the puzzle here that they're getting wrong?
Absolutely. Focusing on adequate hydration all throughout the day and also keeping in mind that hydration is not only water and that they can actually get water through eating plenty of fruits and vegetables. But of course, always having a handy water bottle is a great idea. And then during their sport, probably referring to something like Gatorade or sports drink. So they're getting a little bit more electrolytes and carbohydrates to support their sport demands.
We're visiting with Jen Fields, Assistant Professor of Nutritional Science in the University of Connecticut's College of Agriculture, Health, and Natural Resources. She participated in a study, now published in the journal Nutrients, of high schoolers' nutrition knowledge. Professor, in addition to athletes having enough energy to power their performances, what other important effects do athletes get from having proper nutrition?
It's going to help them recover. It's going to help them focus in school. It's going to help them really support their health long term. And what a lot of athletes don't realize, or really kids in general, what they don't realize is their health right now is really setting the stage for their long term health many years from now. And for example, peak bone mass is accrued by the time kids are about 20 years old or so. So this high school and early college is such a key population where we need to make sure they're getting adequate calories, protein, vitamin D, and calcium to support their growing skeleton. Because if they're not getting those nutrients now, then it sets them up for increased risk of injury, but also increased risk of osteoporosis later on in life.
Jen Fields, Assistant Professor of Nutritional Science in the University of Connecticut's College of Agriculture, Health, and Natural Resources. Thank you so much for joining us today. Very interesting topic.
Thank you so much, Gina.
For InfoTrack, I'm Gina Tedesco.
That's it for another edition of InfoTrack. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm Chris Whitting, inviting you to join us next week for another edition of InfoTrack.
Well, I went down to the Grundy County Auction, where I saw something I just had to have. My mind told me I should proceed with caution, but my heart said go ahead and make a bid on that. And I said, hey, pretty lady, won't you give me a sign? I'd give anything to make your mind on mine. I'll be your bidding and be at your beck and call. Yeah, I've never seen anyone looking so fine. Man, I gotta have her, she's a one of a kind. I'm going once, going twice. I'm sold on the lady in the second row. She's an 8, she's a 9, she's a 10, I know. She's got ruby red lips, blonde hair, blue eyes, and I'm about to bid my heart goodbye. The auctioneer was going about a mile a minute. He was taking bids and calling them out loud. And I guess I was really getting in it, 'cause I just shouted out above the crowd. And I said, hey, pretty lady, won't you give me a sign? I'd give anything to make your mind on mine. I'll do your bidding and be at your beck and call. Yeah, I've never seen anyone looking so fine. Man, I gotta have her, she's a one of a kind. I'm going once, twice. I'm sold on the lady in a long black dress, but she won my heart, it was no contest. With a ruby red lips, blonde hair, blue eyes, well, I'm about to bid my heart goodbye. Yeah, we found love on the auction block, and I hauled her heart away. Now we still love to laugh about the way we met that day when I said, hey, pretty lady, won't you give me a sign? I'd give anything to make your mind on mine. I'll do your bidding and be at your beck and call. Yeah, second row, she's an 8, she's a 9, she's a 10, I know. She's got ruby red lips, blonde hair, blue eyes, and I'm about to bid my heart goodbye.
Like a rainy Sunday morning makes me want to stay in bed, twisted up all day long. You're my inspiration, girl, you take me places, put the words right into these songs. Stealing kisses undercover, babe, see forever when I see your face, and I swear God made you for me. You make it rough around the edges, never let it ruffle up your feathers, angel. Yeah, I'm down for life, you got me wrapped around your finger, and I like it just in case you can't tell. You make it easy, loving up. see your face, and I swear God made you for me.
Sometimes you stand, sometimes you turn your back to the wind. There's a world outside every darkened door, where blues won't haunt you anymore, where the brave are free and lovers soar. Come ride with me to the distant shore. We won't hesitate to break down the garden gate. There's not much time left today, yeah.
I love you now like I loved you then. This is the road and these are the hands. Come on, sing me to the ever seen a prayer in person? The kind of thing that makes you believe all the waiting round was worth it. But one of them meant to be. Mine showed up out of nowhere in just a t-shirt and some jeans. And I knew right then, right there, she looked like forever to me. She gave 18 summers to Carolina. Spent a few more wild and free. Gave a long shot chance to a Georgia boy in Tennessee. I gave a promise to her daddy and a grass stain to my knee. I might have gave her the diamond, but she gave forever to me. Well, there ain't no dancing around it when your whole world's standing there. Just cause we talked about it didn't mean I wasn't scared. And right there where I met her, yeah, I showed her the ring. And just waiting on her answer, Lord, felt like forever to me. Yeah, she gave 18 summers to Carolina. Spent a few more wild and free. Gave a long shot chance to a Georgia boy in Tennessee. I gave a promise to her daddy and a grass stain to my name. I might have gave her the diamond, but she gave forever to me. Yeah, she gave forever to me. She gave a yes to the dress with her mama. That's gonna be something to see. She gave her heart to Jesus, and he gave. Wish you could have met my daddy. Know how happy he would be that I gave her a diamond and she gave forever to me.
Opioid manufacturer Purdue Pharma's Political Action Committee donated to just one Wisconsin candidate in 2016. That candidate was extreme politician Judge Brad Schimmel. The company also gave money to a national Republican group whose PAC spent nearly $3 million on Schimmel's 2018 election. From the year 2000 to 2017, Wisconsin had over 7,500 opioid-related deaths. Democratic and Republican attorneys general from other states and 71 out of 72 counties filed lawsuits against Purdue Pharma, but Brad Schimmel refused to join them. Thousands of Wisconsinites died. Wisconsin people should always take priority over profits. Tell Judge Brad Schimmel to look out for Wisconsinites, not out-of-state drug companies. Call 262-548-7548. That's 262-548-7548. Paid for by Better Wisconsin Together Incorporated.
Celebrate the women who have helped shape the world as we honor Women's History Month with powerful stories of Wisconsin's own. We appreciate the groundbreaking efforts of Janine Geske. She dedicated her career to transforming the criminal justice landscape. Geske taught in prison and collaborated with victims groups. She continued to champion for change as a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court during the 1990s. And in recognition of her impact, she was named the Milwaukee Bar's Lawyer of the Year twice. She also made history in 2002 as the first and still the only woman to serve as Milwaukee County Executive, an interim role worked without pay. Geske's now a professor of law at Marquette University's Restorative Justice Initiative, which she founded in 2005. We recognize the powerful women from the past and those who are still writing their own history today. I'm Jane Matnair.
We were born in this little town. Growing up, I was counting down every single day to so we made our getaway. But you said you could never see yourself trying to make a life anywhere else. This would be your home, and I was on my own. But ever since you said goodbye, I've been out here on the wind. And baby, you would be surprised at all the places you have been. I've seen you in Albuquerque, waiting out a blizzard. Arizona, dancing across the desert, watching the sun set in Monterey. Girl, I swear, just the other day you were down in Georgia, picking them peaches. Carolina, barefoot on the beaches. No matter where you choose to be, in my heart I'll always see you everywhere. Days when I'm passing through, the conversation always turns to you, and I hear you're doing fine, living out by the county line. Got a man that's home every night, a couple of kids, and the kind of life that you want to lead. Yes, you could say the same for me. But you and I made our choices all those years ago. Still, I know I'll hear your voice and see you down the road. Maybe in Oklahoma, driving across the prairie. So maybe that's why you're on every highway, just beyond the high beams, right beside me in all of my sweet dreams. No matter where you choose to be, in my heart I'll always see you. In Albuquerque, waiting out a blizzard, in Arizona, dancing across the desert, watching the sunset in Monterey. Girl, I swear, just the other day you were down in Georgia, picking them peaches. In Carolina, barefoot on the beaches. No matter where you choose to be, in my heart I'll always see you everywhere.
Living out of loving you. Early every morning when the sun comes up, I'm punching that clock on the wall, breaking my back just to make a buck, wishing I was in your arms. If I could make a living out of loving you, I'd be a millionaire in a week or two. I'd be doing what I love and loving what I do. If I could make a living out of loving. I can work all day and feel right at home, loving that 8 to 5.
never have to leave you here alone when I'm working overtime. If I could make a living out of loving you, I'd be a millionaire in a week or two. I'd be doing what I love.